Hey Blenders, on this week's show, we're going to discuss In the Heights box office. We have reviews of Pixar's Luca, and F9 director Justin Lin joins us for a conversation.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 169 of Real Blend, a podcast that still lives its life a quarter of a mile at a time. This week on the show, we're going to be discussing In the Heights box office. Was it good? Was it bad? What were the reasons for it? We're going to review Pixar's new film, Luca, and then F9 director Justin Lin is joining us for a fantastic, fantastic interview on the show. And I know it's early and that F9 is coming, but we have a couple of really good interviews in the pipeline that we wanted to get to you guys. And it's not spoilery. We don't get spoilery in terms of all the conversations, but he goes into some really cool stuff about the Fast and Furious franchise and his place in it. Before we get to the show, of course, let me introduce the guys. We are slightly less good looking this week because we're down Jake Hamilton, but we're replacing him with Gabe Kovach. Hi, Gabe. How are you doing?
I think I bring us right back up. You know,
I think so too. Out. Yeah, that's fair. That's very fair.
I would argue that Gabe's hair is on par with Jake's hair. I mean, Gabe has some pretty epic hair. I don't think we ever talk about how epic Gabe's hair is.
We take you a little bit behind the curtains of the show. Gabe was stressing out about his hair before we got started today, saying that it was too high, and I said don't
have, well have I was you laughing seen at the tidal wave that's on top of my head right now.
I was laughing about the timing of I'm getting a haircut tomorrow, so tomorrow would have been, you know, Thursday would have been a great day to record this, but
yes, well, the tidal wave was on top of Kevin McCarthy's head. Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington DC. Hi, Kev.
And I don't think I've told you guys this, but on my head right now is the actual prop from the wave from Deep Impact. They actually just borrowed my hair, and the one that they had, the wave that kills Tia Leone. This is it. No, it's good to see you guys, and looking forward to talking about the box office. I know we're gonna have an interesting discussion about In the Heights, and Justin Lin. I'm super excited that he's on the show, by the way, because you guys know I'm a big Fast fan. So there's some cool little nuggets in there if you're a fan of the franchise.
Oh my God, so many great stories that he tells. So we're gonna get to that in a second. But if you're watching us on YouTube and taking a look at all the hair of the Real Blend co-hosts, thank you very much for joining us. Hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. You'll be one of the first ones to come and watch the show when it gets posted. If you're listening to us where you get your podcast needs met, head to the description, and in there we can tell you how to sign up for Real Blend Premium, which is a new episode that comes out only for subscribers on Monday. In addition to the new episode, you get a newsletter from me. You get an ad-free experience for the show, and just a lot of really great fun content. So go to cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. This week's episode is going to be about the 2005 Academy Awards and whether 2004 Academy Awards and whether the Academy got it right. And Kevin and I now play this fun game where we don't look at the nominees before we go into that show.
And we I actually prefer it that way. Yeah,
it should be a fun one. And I think this will be a fun year.
Sometimes we get surprised at what's
I think we've gone through most of the major, like, controversial years, but it's the Oscars, so every year there's always bad decisions for us to
harp on.
To clarify something, is 2004 the crash, the year with Crash and Brokeback Mountain, or is that 2005, or am I way off on that?
No, we already did that year. I think it's 2005. Okay, we've already covered that year, yeah.
Okay, cool.
That is another good controversial one, though.
Yeah.
This week's poll, which is going to get us into our first talking point, is, and Kevin, you get to play this one, will In the Heights earn a Best Picture nomination? Now, the phrasing is not should it. The phrasing is very specifically will it. So, however many months from now, when the Oscar nominations come out, do you think In the Heights is going to make the cut? Actually, I'm sorry. What do you think our listeners said first? I only gave them two choices, yes or no.
I think our listeners said no.
Okay, so on YouTube, 69% of the people who participated in the poll said no. But here's what's pretty interesting. On Twitter, 60% of the people said yes. So the conversation was split in different directions depending on what social media platform that you participated in. So personally, Kev, where do you think it falls? Do you think it has a chance of getting in?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I've seen We're in June now? I mean, there hasn't been anything crazy in terms of Oscar-worthy material yet. I mean, in the sense of what we consider to be Oscar-worthy, or the Academy deems Oscar-worthy. Remember, we also have West Side Story opening this year, which is another musical. I'm not saying that one musical can get in and one can't, but I, you know, with Spielberg, I mean, I'm sure it's going to be incredible. But In the Heights, you know, I think, you know, Sean, I know you saw it. It's a very, very good movie. I didn't give it a 5 out of 5. I actually wouldn't probably say it's going to be nominated. Personally, I think it's a very good film. Mm-hmm. I would even go on borderline incredible in terms of the filmmaking and Esther Williams homages and the, you know, it's a really well-made film, but I don't think it's going to be a Best Picture nomination.
You brought up a point that I think is very interesting to bring in, that I think that the Academy is going to have a kind of unwritten rule when they're looking at the slate, and they're going to say that, like, one of the musicals, there's three big ones, it's In the Heights, it's West Side Story, and even Dear Evan Hansen, if that ends up being a really good movie. I can't see two of them getting in. I really just think people who are nominating are going to be like, well, we're not going to put two musicals in. Whether that's fair or not, you know? Right. I just think, as a person, they're going to say, like, oh, I don't want to put two in.
Well, and so, it's the recency of it, too. Like, the West Side Story will have the benefit of being the new musical.
Absolutely. So.
Also, you know, In the Heights, it's interesting, and I know we're going to dive into this in the box office. It's just a really interesting film, and I think we'll dive into more critical elements of it as well. It's a very, very good movie. Like, I genuinely enjoyed it in the theater. It was vivid. It was entertaining. It was electrifying. I just don't know if it had, I don't know if it surpassed that, like, brilliant level for me. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It was, like, at the line, and, like, there's a, you know, an amazing sequence where two characters, Corey Hawkins, Leslie Grace, are dancing on the side of a building. They built out a gigantic spinning wall like Nolan did in Inception with the hallway. So, I mean, there's some filmmaking in this movie that is truly astounding. I would argue that you're talking about nominations. I could see cinematography. Mm-hmm. I could see, you know, some of the technical elements of it.
Sure.
It just depends. I don't know. Because we have 10 nominations possible, I never really know the answer to this question because it could be anything. They could nominate anything.
Sure.
It's at the moment, though, I just don't know. Like, I'll tell you right now, and I know this is completely off topic, talking about movies that I've watched recently, and I know it's not really a movie, it's more of a special, but I watched that Bo Burnham special, Inside.
So glad you watched that.
I'm telling you right now, I've never seen anything that astounding in a long time. And like almost to the point where it just kind of blew everything out the rest of the year from what I've seen so far. Yeah. It was just like, what did I just experience? Like from a filmmaking perspective, from a storytelling perspective. And we should get into this at some point in the show. But I genuinely believe that everyone needs to watch this. I was blown away by how he made me feel like I felt during the time we were all home. Like he really captured what that mentality was like for people. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. And I don't know if you would even call it a movie. I know it's a special, but it seems like a movie to me.
It's hard to categorize it. It's its own thing, which is kind of part of its brilliant. We can discuss a little bit now. We didn't have a chance to talk about it last week, but I think even Jake, I think all of us were blown away by it. I've seen it twice now and I intend to watch it a third. Because it's that
good.
It's
a musical, by the way. That's what kind of why I brought up In the Heights. There's a musical aspect to it.
The songs are incredibly creative.
Yeah.
And it's a musical. It's one of those projects that made me frustrated watching it because I will never be that creative. Like, I think I'm a fairly creative person. And then I watch something like that and I'm just like, I'm useless. I'm useless. Well, it's because he did it in quarantine, you know? Like, how do you do that with the limitations that he was faced?
I love that it's, if you've watched Bo Burnham sort of coming up and his comedy, it's very much Bo Burnham and his comedy. But if you watched Eighth Grade and you kind of saw, you know, as he stepped away from comedy and started doing filmmaking, Eighth Grade is a brilliant film, an amazing film. And this is like a beautiful marrying of those two kind of sides of his creativity where it has this sort of surreal, you don't know what's real, you don't know what isn't movie aspect to it, but it's rooted in sort of his perspective and the kind of thing that he's always brought to comedy, which I love. And it's incredibly layered throughout, which is great. Like he's always been really good about having, even just within a song, having layers within the song, jokes within jokes. Mm-hmm. But there's little stuff where like he opens up sort of being self-aware about him being a white guy who wants to heal the world through comedy. And then he has a song, you know, 20 minutes later where he's like, you can't just absolve yourself of everything by being self-aware. And it's like, it's a fun way where he sort of is self-aware, but he criticizes himself being self-aware. He reflects that in the whole,
reaction video. He calls out a lot of social topics, a lot of big social topics, and he deflates them, you know, but doesn't do it in a way, it's still extremely accessible. Like, no matter what group you're in, you listen to what he says and you're like, God damn, he's right. Like, that's, he's right what he's saying.
There was a moment where I realized that what I was watching was a masterpiece or brilliant. It was, did you guys get a sense when you watched it that, like, as he would take us through the production process internally throughout the film, he would say, I don't know if I'm going to finish this or not finish this. Even though I was watching the final product, I was worried he wasn't going to finish it. I kept thinking to myself, wait, please finish it, Bo. I want to watch what you're doing here, even though I'm literally watching it.
Yeah, it has that sort of surreal mockumentary, like, you know, what's the movie I'm thinking of, the Before Blair Witch. It has that sort of like, is this a real thing that happened or is this all staged? But he gives you so many hints of like, yes, it's all staged, but he can still kind of wrap you up in the fiction of it all. I think it's great, obviously.
I have a tech question, Gabe, because you're really big on tech stuff too. Since he filmed and edited and shot the whole thing himself, how is he getting those zooms on time? Was that done through editing?
I think he was just doing digital zoom. That camera can shoot in I think at least 4K, so he was probably just doing digital zooms in and out and just doing it nice and slow like that. You get that effect. I didn't see, like, in the stuff he had lying around, I didn't see any sort of actual like dolly rig
track.
But there are, especially for cameras that size, there are a lot of rigs where you can set them up to sort of push and pull on their own. You can program them to do it at a certain speed and timing. So he might have had that and I just didn't see it. But I think a lot of it was just simply he was really good at composing the frame and making it interesting at these different levels of sort of focal length or zoom, and then was slowly pushing in and pushing out. There's different ways you can automate that. I think it was all digital, though. I could be wrong.
When you see him having like a struggle with repeat, like when he picks up a mic and he's like doing something that was supposed to be for the movie and he like gets frustrated and kicks the stuff away. And do you think that stuff is real or do you think that stuff is performed?
I think that that stuff is written from reality. Like, I think that he was struggling to do it. And so he put it in the film he wrote it as like, how would I shoot this? What do I want to do in that scene of me struggling to come up with ideas or being frustrated with this? It's fabricated, but I think it's definitely why it feels so real is it's probably based in his process.
But I think he's choreographed all of it down 100%. to the second, because we went back and watched a couple of his other comedy specials and he makes jokes about how choreographed his shows are. Like, he's like, this looks impromptu, but right now I'm going to do this. And then like a sound effect will play. And you know that he was just like leading you up to the moment that the sound effect.
And
there's another bit that he did too. And I'm trying to think of how he set it up, but it had to do with the shirt that he was wearing. And like, he turns and then he's coming back and he's wearing a different shirt. But the only way that I could think that he did it is that from the moment you saw him in the second shirt, you were watching the back half of a different performance, you know?
Sure.
And like, he visually brought you up to that point and then switched and then went another. And I think a lot of his comedy is sort of.
And I think he tries to tell you that it's all staged towards the end, because he comes in and it's. Maybe he even staged it at the end of shooting, but it looks like it was like a day one, day three, early on in the shoot. He comes in at the end and he says, oh, here's a idea for the ending song, you know, take one. It's not quite finished. And that is the intro to the last song or the ending song. Hmm. And so I think that's him telling you, like, this is all built, which is kind of ties back to the metaphor of a lot of his pieces about social media and how fake it is and sort of what that can do to our minds. And he's kind of, I think it's brilliant. And it's like,
I'm
you said, Sean, it is maddening. You're like, well, okay. I guess I can make the second best thing. Maybe I can make the second best thing.
The commentary video is the one where I was just like, fuck.
Oh my God. So good.
Yeah.
So I sent you guys the screenshot of that poor sap on YouTube who did a reaction to one of his videos from it. And I was like, oh, this guy is a part of the joke and he does not realize.
Yeah. It's it's so interesting because he's commenting. What I find brilliant about it is like he's making legitimately great songs.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
are like the genuinely commenting. It's so good. And I said this in a tweet too. I almost felt like I shouldn't have been watching this. Like what I mean by that is like I felt like I was looking into his life and his private life, and I shouldn't have been.
Yeah,
I should not. It felt invasive. It was so raw.
Well, and how many people that we interviewed during quarantine where we asked them a lot of times, like, how did you stay creative? You know, like you're by definition a creative person. So, and we're all in this locked up spot. Like, how did you stay creative? And here he is. This is special, just showing you essentially. Here's how I struggled with my creativity, right. And you have this special as a result of it. So
it's I want to believe that what I was watching emotionally was real. Like I just want to believe it. Like I want to believe that what he was going through was real, because it was so it just hit me so hard emotionally. Not only just the commentary about social media, because everything, you know, it's so interesting how he puts it. But I just it made me feel less alone in terms of like depression and anxiety. I'm like, I hope that this is real. I hope that we're watching somebody who's turning anxiety into art and using it to help people. Because like I felt helped by the video. I felt, I don't know, I woke up this morning after watching it. I just felt better. Yeah, and I don't know that, like, you know, and I, you know, I deal with depression generally, but like I just felt like I wanted to live my life better when I woke up this morning after watching
it.
Just really kind of
can watch it again anytime you want to. So it's Bo Burnham's Inside. If people haven't seen it yet, it's on Netflix. And then in addition, a bunch of his other comedy specials are, and we would recommend highly that you check them out. Another thing that's going to make people feel really good, especially if you're into the Fast and Furious franchise, is F9, which is coming to theaters very soon. And we had Justin Lin on the show. Justin Lin has directed multiple episodes of the Fast and Furious franchise, took a break after 6, passed the baton to James Wan, who then passed it to F. Gary Gray, who directed Fate of the Furious. And now Justin Lin is back, and he's, I think, going to stay with it for the finale, don't you think? He's going to see it all
I
the way through?
I think so. There's two more, right?
Yes,
three
two
more.
I think it's two three? More. I think there is
another one. Two-part.
Oh, they're doing 10. You're right. Okay, you're right.
Yeah. So without further ado, Justin Lin talking F9 and the Fast and Furious franchise on the Real Blend Podcast.
All right, Justin, thank you so much for joining the Real Blend podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you with us. I'm going to start off by thanking you for opening the film with the older Universal logo. And I wanted to ask about using that, and then I'll transition that question into it, because when that logo pops up, you can feel the grain almost of like the film. And then we open up in the past. And I wanted to ask in terms of like, did you use your film, your 35mm film stock to shoot that older footage? And then you went digital, it looked like, in the newer scenes. So talk about incorporating that older logo and then kind of like the filming technique you use for past and present.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where, I mean, I love shooting on film. And, you know, the way things move now, especially with multi-units and stuff, with these big stunts, because sometimes we have so many camera setups that it felt like, at least with this franchise, it had to evolve a little bit. And so it kind of went into the digital. I believe me, Fast 6, we shot on film. So I was still like really fighting. But I think in this case, trying to really have a visual distinction between the two time periods, it felt very natural. So, you know, I was able to use digital. But, you know, there's also some stuff I use on top of it just to kind of make sure that we still feel the texture. But on the flashbacks, definitely, you know, we shot all that on film. And it wasn't even just shooting it on film, but the rule was that whatever we were going to do, every shot that was designed, I didn't want to use anything that wasn't of period. So, like, you know, even with our aerial unit, I would call Fred North and say, hey, man, loosen up the gyro, you know, because I don't want it to be so perfect. And so it was a great exercise, you know. And then the logo for Universal, I'm glad you caught that. You know, I actually went into a deep dive. That logo is actually not perfectly of period. But when I used the one that was of period, it really just stood out, you know. And the one we use is definitely the older one. I love the grain, and it matched, because I wanted to, I know we talk about it as flashback, but I was hoping that subconsciously we're engaging this film as if that's the starting point and that they're actually flashing forward.
I felt like such a nerd in my theater because when that logo went up, you just heard me in a crowd of people go, "Hey, look!" Like I because I hadn't seen it in forever. So that's this is the perfect podcast for you.
You guys made my day. I thought, is anybody in the world gonna get this at all? So
this podcast,
thank you.
We are the nerds. Thank you. We're the nerds who get that.
So Justin, I'm continuously in awe of what you're able to pull off from a practical standpoint. Your practical effects, that video that you tweeted of how you got the car to sort of crash through the building with the magnets is unbelievable. Was there anything that you really, really wanted to do practically that you just ended up looking at it and going like, I can't, like, we have to use CGI for this?
Oh, that's a great question. I gotta tell you, it was this train ride to Edinburgh for a scout that Han actually came alive on that trip, because I was working on the Justice for Han. And there was a period where Justice for Han was going to be served in flashback. You know, it was a crazy trip, and that was the trip. Up to that point, I was gonna get a Fiero, and I was gonna put it on a weather balloon, and we were gonna take it up to outer atmosphere. But the cost of it, and also just how to get it back, it became this logistical nightmare that I ended up using, like, you know, obviously for reference, we were using real footage, but. Talking to you now, I feel like, damn, that was the one thing that, you know, I was going to put the cameras on there, but the recon of trying to get all that, the logistics.
Do you want actors in the car as it was going
No. No, I did. But I got talked out of that very quickly, but I was actually going to put the car, or at least a frame of a car, and I was going to do the mount shots and everything, and I was going to just. We're just gonna get it up there, you know. We did all the research, but it was gonna take, you know. I mean, the number of conversations I had about that was insane. But I think ultimately, you know, I still had a budget that I was trying to, you know. Ultimately, you know, it probably would have been more for reference, and I think as we talk now, I felt like, man, I should have just done it anyway. I should just held firm.
I feel so bad for the insurance team on this movie. Like, I cannot imagine how much you keep them up at night.
I think that's part of the fun, for sure.
Justin, I'm glad you sort of brought up the idea of Justice for Han and how you guys were almost reverse engineering the situation that you've been given. And so I wanted to know, and I'm glad you heard it say that you thought about doing it in flashbacks. What were some other ideas you guys were kicking around for how you were going to explain the resurrection?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when I came back, it wasn't the main drive wasn't Justice for Han. It was this idea of exploring the theme of family, but through blood. I was very excited about that because I knew that if we did that, there's an opportunity to explore kind of the origin of this mythology, and we get to solidify it, you know. But then, you know, I think being away, and I'd heard about this Justice for Han movement, and, you know, like, at first, I didn't even know it was my Han, you know? I thought, we left, you know? Like, I came in with him, and I left with him, and I was cool with that. But when I found out what happened, I was just as baffled and kind of upset, because I felt like this is one of the most beloved characters, and the way it was treated, it was like as if he was a non, like, and I think him being maybe Asian American and also so close to me and my journey, it definitely did strike a nerve, so... you know, I felt like we had to do something, you know, and I'll say this. I actually feel fortunate, because if none of that happened, Han actually wouldn't even be back. Right. And so, so the fact that he's back, I would say him being back is not justice. You know, I think it's how we treat him from this point on out. I think that's justice for me. And in a way, how we treat every character is the way we, you know, I think that was the spirit of FAST when we started. It's something that, you know, coming back, it has special meaning.
You know, Justin, I've been a fan of this franchise for 20 years, so much so that a little dialogue moment in the car from the first one where Vin's explaining that he beat someone within an inch of his life, that comes full circle here and you like get to play it all out. But one of the things I really, you know, I've been watching these films, I'm emotionally invested in these characters. And with Paul Walker, I was very interested in knowing kind of how you navigate, how you explain his absence in the films. And I think the way you did it here was brilliant, to be honest with you. I was talking to my wife after I saw it. I'm like, that was a really smart way to do it, because I wanted to ask if you could talk about in terms of how you found the proper way to explain Brian's absence in the world, and kind of like, did you have other ideas and kind of how'd you come up with the one you did?
Oh man, it's a constant conversation for me, even with myself. Constant. You know, I obviously Paul is very close to me, to this franchise, and you know, his passing happened while I was away. So the decision to have Brian live on in the universe, you know, it was very interesting, and in a way I'm kind of glad that he's still living on, you know, in the universe. But coming back, you know, obviously that's a huge issue. And whatever we do, I want to make sure it's thoughtful and that it's done out of respect. And on this one, because of the existence of Jacob, you know, he's not only brother to Dom, but he's also brother to Mia. It felt like it was also a way to bring Mia and Jordana back into the franchise. But yeah, I would say, you know, I can't even count the amount of conversations and attempts. I mean, I would say Fast 9, I think we had a script, and I would say that I have like three other scripts. Like there was a Han script. Like you could almost have a movie about Han, the amount of work we did, you know? There's probably a script about young Dom and Jacob that we worked on, you know? And then so I think I felt like coming back and it's 20 years, we maybe for the first time we earned the right to be able to take a little break and really kind of explore these things. And hopefully if you don't get everything you want, you know that there was a lot of thought that got put into it. And maybe one day that story will come to life.
Mm. Wow. Thank you. Wow.
You know, Justin, one of the interesting things that comes with a new Fast movie coming out is discovering what it's going to be called. Like you never, you know, whether it's F9 or Fast 5 or Fast and Furious or The Fate of the Furious. For the next film, how is it not going to be Fast 10, like fasten your seatbelts, like F-A-S 10 for seatbelts?
I love that. It's interesting, you know. I'll tell you, you know, if you watch Fast 6, it's called Fast and Furious 6, right? But when you watch a movie, it's called Furious 6.
Yeah, I remember that. And then I remember
seeing that junket in London. Yes, we remember. Yeah. And Kevin and I looked at each other in the theater, and we go, "Wait, what is this? Which one is this called?
What's it called?"
Yeah. Oh, it was. It's so. This is something that happens all the time. And obviously, you know, I have a great time. We have a great relationship with the. I have a great relationship with the studio. But I was like, man, it was called Fast 5 so you can have Furious 6. That was always by design. And somehow, for some reason, it became Fast and Furious 6. So there are some very heated, I would say spirited conversations about titles. But you know, I think we always have fun in how we choose to kind of label each new chapter. I think that came from when Vin and I first got together, and you know, this is just talking him into coming in to do that one scene for Tokyo Drift, you know, and we talked about like the connection between the characters and all that, and if we were lucky enough to make another one, like let's not do the same thing over and over again. Let's try to like challenge ourselves. Let's evolve the franchise. Let's evolve the characters. And so I think the spirit of that actually went all the way in naming our movies. So, you know, I think F9 is the one, you see the Fast Saga. It's actually, for the first time, our commitment to not just the one movie and earning another one. It's actually our commitment to a chapter. So Fast 9 is kind of, I think it's about, you know, bringing characters back, introducing new characters, but hopefully we're setting everything up now for our final chapter.
I got to tell you, if the next one ends up being called Fast 10 or Fast, like, I want an associate producer credit
on that.
You're getting
nothing. You're getting nothing.
Get it, yeah.
Associate producer credit. It's on camera.
Justin, I promise you that this next question will be pulled and saved for long after the movie is open, because I don't want to ruin anything. But I have to tell you that I think the move that you made in Fast 5 to bring The Rock in is one of the most genius moves in a long-running franchise, probably that I've ever seen. Like, I can't imagine how much that invigorated the action on screen, and he's a personality that just fit, right? So we get to your mid-credits sequence. You pull a thread that starts to bring a lot of characters back in. Don't you think that The Rock has to be part of the finale?
Well, it's interesting the way you're phrasing that, because I actually, you know, and I do this on all the movies, right? Like, it's like a weekend for me of fun of like, all right, cool. Like Fast Five, what's Sean Boswell doing, you know, or whatever, you know? It's funny if you ever, I think Vin still has it. He literally has like this board and has every character in the universe. And it has like those threads, you know, that like connects everybody. It's like I feel like I'm in the FBI or something looking for a serial killer. But I think that's always been our approach, you know. The fun of it is like, yes, we're going to be able to like hopefully share something with everybody for 2 hours. But so many of the conversations I have is about characters that's not even in there, but it's still, obviously, they're living and breathing in the universe. So, you know, on this one, when I came back, I was thinking a lot about Hobbs and Shaw and all the other characters, you know? And so I never think of them as being gone, for sure. Okay. So, yeah.
That's awesome. All right, Justin, I'm going to bring this up because Jake mentioned the shot already, but I want our show is designed to talk about filmmaking and practical effects. I know you've talked about this before, but I want you to tell our audience, since we have a little bit of a longer form here, about that 4-second sequence as the car is pulled through the building into the yellow truck. A lot of people would probably assume that something like that would have to be done by CGI. And clearly you were like, no, we're doing this practically. And I gotta tell you, yesterday I was watching this film in a theater. The practical effects in this film are absolutely insane. Like, it felt like you found this perfect balance. I would almost call it like Jurassic Park, in the sense where like you have that perfect balance between CGI and practical. It feels like it's meshed in a way where you can't tell what's what. And I think that's a great thing you've done as a filmmaker. But for our audience, can you walk us through the process of that scene? And because it's a magnet scene for people who are listening who don't know what we're referring to, the magnet pulls this car through a building into a yellow truck. Tell us how you did it.
Wow. I think to fully kind of tell that story, probably I would say we got to go back to Fast 5, you know, because when I first started, it's interesting because when it comes to action, a lot of times you come up with an idea and there's, you know, there's the best effects people out there, whether it's, you know, it used to be special effects, there's still a big part of it, but then visual effects started to kind of come in and it becomes a negotiation of the two. And there's never like a right way. It's just your way, how you want to use the ingredients, you know? And I remember on Fast Five, I wanted to flip that bus, you know? And I learned very quickly, the people who design buses are amazing because they don't want the bus to flip. They're not supposed to flip. and so I'm having meeting
Makes
with-
sense.
With special effects, and they're like, oh, so it's a one cannon to a pole, and we need to cover it, you know, in two shots and this and that. And I said, no. Like, how do we do that in one shot? And they're like, you can't, like, can you? And I said, no, let's do it in one shot. And so they went back to their drawing board. We ended up creating the, like, two cannons, one of the biggest cannons I've ever seen. And Corey Eubanks, Bob Eubanks' son, was the stunt driver that day, right? And we actually went out and we were shooting. And I remember the first time he skidded that bus, and it went over. But the cannon, I still remember, I was in the long lens. I was like a half a mile away. The cannon didn't go off. It was a 50-cent piece that didn't trigger. And I'm sitting there, and I could see the cannon pointing towards us. And it was like, run! And we're running away, and that day it didn't work, and then so we had to, like, I remember I ran back to the lab. This is when we still, like, budgets really tight. And I said, do not release the negative. I do not want the studio. I don't want anybody to see the footage. I want to control the footage. And we went back and I talked them into giving us another day. And so, because it was so new, they were building all these things. And then the second time we tried it, it went off and that bus just flipped. And it was unbelievable. But it was that day kind of changed everything for us in that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, let's really talk about the beats. Let's not say, oh, well, this is the way it's always been done. Let's talk about how can we really achieve this in, because I have the smartest, most talented people in the world, you know? And so I feel like that was a turning point for me and for us. And so this goes all the way to like the vault, you know, the vault scene, you know, again, when you read the script, people are like, oh yeah, it's a VFX. And I'm like, well, does it have to be? And so we were in Puerto Rico and I said, hey, you know, let's build a structure. So we built this open structure of a cube. And we literally put it on two cars and we just dragged it. And we didn't know what was going to happen, but it was amazing. It was taking out sidewalks and everything in this lot. And I was like, so we're going to do this practically. And again, it was like, you know, it was me, I think younger filmmaker, I was trying to figure out like, okay, cool. There's all these ingredients. I can start there and then we can use the tools to help enhance, right? And if anything, I could be sitting in that dark room with, you know, people from around the world and I have a point of reference, you know, because when you're talking about action, everything is subjective. What's real to me and to you could be completely different, you know, but to be able to capture it for real, it changes the game, you know? And so, you know, by time now, you know, I think everyone's used to me, you know, when I said, hey, we're going to suck a car through a building, they're like, okay, we got to figure out how to do this practically first, you know? And so, you know, it took a lot of time to find the right location in Edinburgh to build it, to be able to capture, digitize it. And then I remember first day when we did it, the car actually went through the first window, but it got stuck with all the whiskey bottles and stuff. And so we had to bring in another car and then it ended up costing us three cars, but that took 8 months of prep of different departments of art department, visual effects, special effects, everybody coming together and make sure that we capture, you know, shooting the plates before so the sunlight actually matches, and it just goes on and on. But I love it. I love it. That's the thing.
I love to see a movie about your budget team. Like every day, they're like, "He wants to do what?"
Well, I'll tell you. There's the team that like is sitting there, and we're just coming up with crazy idea. Then you go to the accounting office. I'm sure that's a whole other story. They're the ones.
They're the ones who are furious.
Wow. Well done,
man. That was good.
Well, well, Justin, we're getting the wrap. You have a busy day, man. But we really appreciate you joining us on the podcast. And continued success, man. I hope we get to talk to you again soon.
No, hey, thank you guys for all your passion and everything, man. It means a lot.
Thank you very much to Universal Studios for giving us time with Justin Lin. And Kevin is going to, Kev's a huge Fast and Furious fan. And
yeah.
Kev, give a very, very brief, knowing that you'll get into a full review later, what did F9 do for you?
Yeah, I loved it. And this is coming from somebody who's been a fan of this franchise for 20 years. And to me, this film feels like a love letter to the first one, just in terms of just the scope of the story. And I get Fast and Furious for some people. It's just so over the top and ridiculous and dialogue. I get it. But for me, I sit down and I buy in. I'm all in. I get it. I'm cool with the bad soap opera one-liners. I'm all in on it. And the action in this one, got to give Justin Lin credit, and we talked about it in the interview. You heard all the practical things he went through. Gabe, you're going to dig this when you hear the audio about how he explains how they did the Fast Five sequence with the bank vault, which is just he explained it. It's unbelievable how much he focuses on practical effects. Yeah. And I think a lot of people assume these movies are very CGI heavy, and they are. Don't get me wrong. There's definitely CGI in this film for sure. But at the same time, he's doing what he can do in camera. So I just respect Justin Lin for that.
Film up to a certain point, shot on film, and shoots some of F9 on film as well too.
Yeah, like because F9, for people who are this is super quick, but basically in the Fast 9
franchise, in this particular movie, we go back to Dom's story. So we obviously know John Cena is his brother, Jacob Toretto, but we go back and we learn the story about how Vin Diesel's character, Dominic Toretto, ended up in prison, which is the line he mentions in the first Fast and Furious film. And that all backstory is shot on film. So it, like, the film opens up on 35 and you're on this like racetrack in like the 80s and it's like awesome. And then like, and then we go back and forth between digital and film in terms of the
years. Please tell me we meet the Toretto father. Do we meet the Toretto father?
Oh, am I spoiling this? I don't want to spoil anything.
All right, don't.
Leave it alone, yeah.
That's one of those roles where if they do show them, I hope they cast somebody really perfect. That's all I want to know.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's get to talking points this week. And one of them is something that we brought up earlier, which is In the Heights. So In the Heights opened in theaters and also on HBO Max. And it had a lower than expected domestic poll. People were putting it in the $15 to $20 million range. It ended up with 11.5 million domestic. And on the Real Blend text thread, we were having a lot of conversations about what the cause of that might be, whether it was the fact that the popularity of the show or the demand for the show didn't really exceed the film Twitter bubble, you know, and people on social media talking about how much they were going to enjoy it, whether the fact that it's just available on streaming played into the fact that it was much easier to just press play. And I will say that all of the people who I saw talking about it made sure to emphasize the point, people who had seen it on a big screen, to say, go out of your way to see this movie on a big screen. But I will admit that Michelle and I watched it Saturday night at home on HBO Max. And I would have loved to go out to the movie theater. We just didn't have the time to go out and see it at the movie theater. PJ was having a bunch of friends over to the house. Brennan's at the beach with a friend. Like,
and
we just couldn't get away.
It's 2.5 hours long.
It's long. It is long.
Can I pause you for 1 second?
Sure.
What you just said is interesting because you said we didn't have time to go see it.
Yeah.
If it was a movie you truly wanted to see in theaters, you would have made the time, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. You would have found a window. Like, let's say this was Avengers, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And like you're not a film critic. You're just a guy who's at home with his family.
Yep.
You're not in the business. And like Avengers is playing in theaters.
Yep.
You would find time to go see it.
You're right. You're right. You're 100% right. And because it's, I would want my first experience of that movie to be a big screen. Like the one I'll equate it to is Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad is coming and it's going to be the exact same scenario. It's going to be in theaters and on HBO Max. But I want my first time through with the Suicide Squad to be on a big screen. I made the conscious decision to say, I can watch In the Heights at home. Even
how
after
many
everyone
people
had said,
did that, though? My parents did that, too. And then we'll jump into our box office discussion as well. We'll get into the HBO Max element as well. I know Gabe had a point as well. But these are the questions that are interesting because we've seen films on HBO Max that have done well in theaters, Conjuring and Godzilla vs. Kong. And then you have a film like this where you're kind of in that middle ground where both you and my parents were like, I really want to watch this movie, but I don't want to go out to see it.
Yeah.
And you just wonder how many people did that. And I know there was a great article that I think Jake shared in the thread about, did HBO Max really hurt the box office? And I don't think it's a black and white answer. I think there's a lot of gray area here. But
I agree.
You and Michelle and my mom and dad are four people that probably would have bought tickets to this film in some way, shape, or form at a different day or time, or whatever it was, and given to the box office so you could see it.
Four people who love the movie theater experience.
So
really,
Sean,
like your parents do, we do, yes.
Let me ask you this. Let's say this weekend, you know, I agree that if it was Avengers, I mean, the last month of your life would have been sculpted around going to see this, quite literally.
Yes.
Even if you weren't the managing editor of a site that covers superhero films.
Right.
You would probably still be like, nope, can't do that. Nope, I'm busy that weekend. You know, that's a different...
PJ, your friends aren't coming over. We're going to see Avengers kind
of course,
thing.
Yes. Yeah.
But that aside, let's just say with this, something comes up, whatever. You don't have time this weekend. If you could only see this in theaters for the next 6 months and it was only going to be in theaters for the next, you know, 2 months.
Yeah.
Within that time frame, would you have made time to go see In the Heights within the next few weeks?
Yes, absolutely.
That's what HBO Max loses, is the you go, I don't have time to do that. Rather than getting it in a couple weeks, you just watch it at home and then you forget it in a week. The average audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big problem that they're seeing.
I think that, I think you're correct in that for sure. But one of the things I'm going to fault this campaign for doing is that nothing that the studio did sold me on you need to come out and see this in the, I don't know how they chose to sell it, but they didn't showcase a song well enough or the music well enough to me. There isn't a huge leading star that makes me think like, I know Anthony Ramos, and I don't mind going to go see him in the show. And he was great. He was terrific. But they're beyond, it's a new Lin-Manuel Miranda show. And, everyone knows him from Hamilton. That seemed to be the hook, enough to get people in. And it wasn't enough of a hook that made me say like that. And here's the thing, too. I'll be brutally honest. Like, I told you I was late to Hamilton. And when we watched Hamilton on Disney Plus, when they finally made it available, Michelle and I were like, Jesus, we were idiots for not watching this. I don't think In the Heights is as good as Hamilton. I think it's Hamilton not. Is way better. I think the music is way better. So I was a couple of songs deep into In the Heights, and I looked at Michelle and I was like, this is pretty good. But I wasn't blown away by it.
Well, it's interesting because when Hamilton hit Broadway or pre-Broadway, if you think about it from that bubble perspective, there was no real famous song in that show,
right?
And
sure.
or and Person. Or famous star in the show, but that show obviously gained a very specific traction. It became arguably one of the biggest shows of all time.
Yeah.
These are interesting debates because In the Heights, you could argue, falls in that same category. Not a famous song that we know of yet. I mean, this show was written before Hamilton, so that's another element. Like, people didn't realize that came before Hamilton.
Sure,
it was just coming from the creator of Hamilton. And I think...
Without Hamilton, would this have gotten a movie?
No.
No, probably not.
Right? I think
they're selling it on... From Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of Hamilton. And at the end of the day, In the Heights is very good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this film. It's a gorgeous film. It's incredible in terms of just like what it does in terms of filmmaking and performances. But at the same time, like, it is a tough sell. But you mentioned film Twitter bubble. And this is, I keep having this realization every time this happens and then I forget about it. And then it gets sucked back into the world. And you think that's going to be the biggest thing of all time. You would think, based on my Twitter feed last week, that In the Heights was going to be the biggest movie ever made. it was literally all over my feed. Like, every single person was talking about it. I'm like, this is going to do 50 million. This is going to be huge.
Yeah.
And then it just, as Sunday rolled around, we get the Friday night numbers, the 5 million for Friday, including Thursday previews. And I just stopped to think for a second. I'm like, I sometimes take my Twitter timeline as gospel. Because you just think, and then you forget to realize that there's a whole nother world outside of just that timeline. And I know that sounds obvious.
Right.
But
you just forget how few people that actually is. Like it made $11 million. Right. $11 million at $15 a ticket is a lot of people. That's hard for you to fathom getting that many opinions, on one thing. So it's...
Yeah.
I also think a movie like In the Heights plays extremely well to the New York and LA crowd. It's a theater show, it's a musical, it's an urban show. It doesn't play to middle America. And the other two movies that have come out before it are both sequels. Conjuring has Conjuring franchise behind it. At least you're familiar with it. Quiet Place had at least the popularity of Quiet Place. Quiet Place 2 had the popularity of the first one behind it. So they did okay, not gangbusters. Quiet Place 2 did really well.
Conjuring 3, like, listen out. Guess how much Conjuring 3 has made worldwide so far? Just guess.
Since you say it that way, I'm going to go high, and I'm going to say, like, 110.
112 million.
Oh, damn, that was good.
And we're talking about a movie that wasn't as well critically received.
Yeah.
It's pure brand recognition. Also,
it's
people
a sequel,
just
though.
Love.
I mean, it's a sequel.
People love horror movies.
They do.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
love horror movies. People yeah. love getting scared, man. It's like, Quiet Place, I think, is the first movie post-pandemic or pandemic times to cross 100 million domestically.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
And that's true. I mean, that's a really big deal. And like, it just goes to show you that there's an audience for very specific things. And In the Heights felt like a movie that would be the feel good movie of the summer. That's the way it was billed. And WB, yeah. like, you know, WB promoted the hell out of it. It was everywhere. It was like they did so many interviews and everything. I am very shocked how little it did at the box office. But it's also a very, very... It's kind of a tough sell. If you think about selling that, like without a star and without a big song, you're selling, this is another musical from Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I'm not diminishing it. It's a great story.
Well, let me ask a question.
Like, what is the selling point?
Yeah. Is there a song that stuck with you? Is there one song from it that really stood out to you?
Yeah, 96,000. That pool sequence is... Or no, is that 96,000? Yeah, the pool sequence is 96,000, right? Yeah, the entire pool sequence is... outstanding.
So.
There's a lot of like phenomenal songs.
The grandmother song is really beautiful too.
Oh, Abuelo Claudia is my favorite character in that movie. That character is so brilliant. She's the character who kind of takes care of Anthony's character and kind of the neighborhood specifically. That performance, I think she deserves an Academy Award nomination.
Okay.
That performance is unbelievable. Everybody listening to the show right now, see In the Heights. It's very good. And I
you can watch it for $15 a month or whatever it is.
Yeah. But I honestly think I saw it in a theater and I also watched it at home. The theater experience was way better.
Yeah, I believe it.
And it was, it just sounded better. It looked better, which is awesome.
As we're wrapping up this segment, one thing that surrounding this that we were discussing that I think we're just going to have to continue to track through the rest of the year is that I think I don't know where you guys fall, and I think Jake disagrees with me. I think that the HBO Max strategy is going to negatively affect their box office numbers for the rest of the year. I think the thing we're talking about, The Conjuring, and we're talking about In the Heights, which are very different films, and they're even within each other, they came out at very different times. It feels like, even though they were pretty close, like it feels like there are more theaters. It feels like more people are seeing things right now than they even were when A Quiet Place came out. But as we get into the fall and the late summer and more things are out, there are more than one release a week. They have these big tentpole releases that they're competing with. I just don't see how a general audience is going to look at the slate and they're going to go, do I go see this movie and the movie that I can watch at home? Or do I just go see the movie that I can? I think they're always going to lose the I can watch that at home battle through the rest of the year. Is that a 50% decrease? Is that a 10% decrease of what they would have made? You know, we don't necessarily know, but I suspect and I kind of predict that they're going to consistently lose at the box office, so to speak, compared to their rivals.
Kev, go ahead.
I think the big tell is going to be Black Widow. I think Widow is going to give us a good insight into what this choice. And I think Widow's different because it has a $30 fee at home.
And it's Marvel. But, I mean, it's like, that's like, but, Marvel is its own beast where... The people that go see three movies a year, they go see three Marvel movies. Like that's the market that they tapped, was the four quadrant general audience. So can you really compare Black Widow to what, you know?
I think beyond it, it would be, honestly, if I'm Warner Brothers, and I'm saying this right now on June 15th.
Sure.
If I'm Warner Brothers, I am doing everything in my power to break this HBO Max deal by Suicide Squad.
Someone let us know, who's listening to our show, if does anyone know the legal aspects of this HBO Max thing? Because because basically, from what we understand, they are connected to HBO Max through the end of the year. Then 2022, they go back theatrical, right? That's where we are.
The only thing I can think of is if they have something at all in the contract that when you signed up for it, you know, you signed up for it recently because you thought it would be available to both.
But you just cancel your subscription. There's no, they're not really liable.
No. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, does Warner Brothers have any legal route?
No.
The HBO Max thing.
They did it. They started it without telling anybody in the first place. They can do whatever they want. I mean, that proved when they did it, and even people within their own organization were flipping out about it, and the artists were flipping out about it. Like, I think that shows that they can do whatever they want. And as far as the audience, or as far as their customers, they can cancel anytime they want. There's no, you know, I don't know if they offer any sort of like pay for a year, then maybe you run into an issue where someone, you know, that sounds like a customer service issue that you can handle at that level. Like,
sure.
I don't know that it's really anything major if they just go, I would keep it.
I like HBO Max more than most of the other streaming services. I like the stuff that they offer on it.
Again, they might look at that and say, yeah, we're going to lose 25 or whatever. I'm giving you an arbitrary number I'm making up. We're going to lose 25% of expected gross at the box office for everything through the rest of the year. However, we are leaning that against, by the end of the year, HBO Max is, you know, HBO of Netflix, like is the quote unquote HBO of streaming services now that, that HBO was for cable, if that at all was not confusing. if they can establish themselves as a giant streamer by the end of the year, that might just be the only goal. And that's a fine strategy.
So WBC's Quiet Place is opening weekend, 57 million.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at that and could they have gone, all right, maybe box office is back. Let's just cancel the HBO Max thing and release In the Heights only in theaters. Like, they why couldn't well they make
could,
that decision?
No, they can. They very the well thing could.
Is, that is short term. I don't know that they will, because that is a short term gain. And that's something that Hollywood accountants can very easily write off within a fiscal year. Whereas the HBO Max play is like, this is what we're doing for the long-term. Next 30 years. You know, like, I see them sort of, I could see them sticking to it plainly.
Hmm. Good point. Yeah. All but right. Next year, they're not doing the day and date.
Correct.
No. It's which I think is a good call. I think you're, at that point, you're just losing money for no reason. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool.
And I honestly think before Dune, it goes.
I would love that.
Yeah.
I think that's the case. Does whatever it takes for people to see. You think it will?
I don't think it's going to. I'm saying huge today. I think they're going to get rid of it before Suicide Squad. What if they
delayed Dune so that they could just skip the day and dates?
Yeah. Okay, so wait. Let's get to the next topic, which is the Tick, Tick, Boom trailer, which to me looks fantastic. But based on everything that we just discussed about musicals and Lin-Manuel Miranda, does that mean that this movie doesn't have much of a chance of breaking through to the mainstream? It's about Jonathan Larson, who is the guy who wrote Rent. And he also wrote this show, Tick, Tick, Boom, which is what it's based on. Andrew Garfield plays him in the musical, and it is going to mark Lin-Manuel Miranda's directorial debut. And it looks like it's edited beautifully. It looks like it's in sync with the music and the way that it's being played. And for people who don't know, the playwright passed away at age 36. So if this film goes into that, it has the ability to be really emotional and really tragic. But because of all the reasons that we just laid out for the reason that In the Heights struggled, it makes me wonder if this is going to do well.
Well, In the Heights, again, I haven't seen Tick, Tick, Boom. I've just seen the trailer. Tick, Tick, Boom doesn't feel like an In the Heights style musical where it's like they're just breaking out in song randomly. This seems more concert driven. I mean, again, I could be wrong, but there were parts where Andrew Garfield was singing like in his apartment, but the trailer felt more movie
story driven
than it felt musical. Yeah, and if that makes sense, I don't know if that's the right terminology, but it's interesting because I thought it was a fascinating trailer. I thought it was edited really well. I thought I'm very interested in see what Lin-Manuel is going to do as a director, and I'm very interested. I think Andrew Garfield's one of the best of our generation, so I'm always fascinated by him.
What if we get Lin on the show?
That'd be huge.
It'd be pretty good. Yeah. That'd be a really big get.
Yeah, no. But I mean, the trailer was fantastic. I would watch that film right now. I just thought it was edited. It kind of like got my pulse going. It was just really intense. And I think I would be interested in seeing it. But to your question, this is a Netflix release, so we're not going to really have a box office discussion. It's kind of mute.
They could throw it on their top 10 list and say it was great, and we just assume that's true.
But I wanted to ask you a question, Gabe. Does Andrew Garfield lure people into theaters?
No.
You don't think?
No. I don't know. Sorry, I guess I mean, not. Answer for you, Gabe. No, I think you're right. I guess not. He does for me, but again, it comes back to that echo chamber film Twitter thing of like...
Right.
Andrew Garfield is amazing, and anytime he's doing something this, like, he's been doing a lot of kind of batshit insane kind of interesting projects post-Spider-Man, and so I've been interested in him even just in his choices, let alone his performance themselves. So for me, yes, and I think most people that I know like Andrew Garfield and are excited about it, but I don't think he has... You know, he doesn't really have a mainstream appeal. Like, I don't really know what people are
in mainstream. He's kind of the that guy right? Like the casual audience kind of.
Because like he played Spider-Man, but he played a Spider-Man that kind of came and went, you know? Like his Spider-Man is sort of, well, Sean, you would speak to this. In my opinion, if his kind of feels like it's overshadowed by the Spider-Man before him and the Spider-Man after him. So like
very much 100%.
He doesn't really have a claim to fame in that regard, so.
Right. Like I interviewed Andrew Garfield for that movie 99 Homes, which is a fantastic film. Like remember the movie with him and Michael Shannon?
Yeah.
Like I don't think people are going to a movie for him specifically, but like we think he's a brilliant actor. And like you know, at the end of the day, I don't think someone is going to go to a box office and say, I want a ticket to the new Andrew Garfield film. Now, it could be someone from like film Twitter who loves film. But at the end of the day, like, you know, I don't, my mom and dad, I guess they know who he is because they love movies. But like, it's hard. It's interesting.
Michael Shannon is a pretty good comparison, actually. Michael Shannon is a guy who, when you see him in a thing, you're like, oh, he's going to be great in it.
I'll watch
Michael Shannon movie. Dude, and I'd watch Garfield in anything.
I'll watch an hour and a half reel of him in like terrible commercials if he wants. I'll just...
We're also living in an age where Robert De Niro isn't a box office draw.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, no matter how famous you are, I think, like I've said this before, unless you're Denzel, DiCaprio, there's a few people left, Brad Pitt, like... And then you could also sell it on directors. I would argue directors' names are becoming more important than some stars.
Absolutely.
Like a Nolan movie, a Spielberg movie, you know, a Scorsese film. We're at a point where like the movie star, Quentin Tarantino, I would argue, sold Hollywood.
Directors now, or DiCaprio a brand. Are huge. Like a brand, like a franchise. You know, Marvel, Fast and Furious, like those are gonna bring people in, kind of thing.
Yeah. Like Vin Diesel. Bloodshot's not doing in massive numbers in the United States, but Fast and Furious will, because it's not, they're not going, I guess you could argue they're going for Vin Diesel in Fast and Furious 9, but it's the Fast franchise. It's Dominic Toretto they're going for.
They're going for Dominic Toretto, who is by proxy just Vin Diesel, but.
Let's get to this week in movies, because it starts off with a movie that is actually part of a franchise that people might not even realize is an existing franchise, which is The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. Kev, did you see the sequel?
I have not seen the sequel. I did not love the first one.
Okay, well, I got a chance to go out and see the sequel. Gabe, have you seen either of them?
I've seen neither of them. No, I can't You've say seen neither. They look like my cup of tea.
It is exactly the type of movie nowadays that has just enough generic bit about it that it could crank out three of them and you'd turn around and be like, wait, they made how many of these movies?
Do you see how much money the first one made?
Oh, it went off the charts. Yeah.
Hold on a second. Let me pull this up.
Please
the first
bring
one
it up.
Made so much money. Hold on. Okay. So $30 million budget made $176 worldwide.
Wow. That's insane.
R-rated action film. Like that movie for some reason had the weirdest legs I've ever seen in my entire life.
I think Ryan Reynolds was on a hot streak when that came out. I think Sam Jackson is always going to be Sam Jackson till the day he dies. Yeah. And there's a number of people that are just going to want to see Sam Jackson in a movie. So I think it had plenty of appeal. And that it didn't speak to me. I'll probably catch up on it. Cause again, Ryan Reynolds' sense of humor, especially R-rated sense of humor, I adore. So I probably want to see him in it. And the trailer for this one looks funny, but nothing struck me as like I have to see it.
The director's name is Patrick Hughes.
Patrick Hughes.
Yes. And he's an extremely competent director, but he's not a director that brings any kind of style or a signature where you're like, oh, this is someone to pay attention to. It's just somebody who does a competent, you know, a well-done action film sort of thing. But, you know, I don't know if he's... There's a level of filmmakers that work consistently, you know, that deliver, like they're not David Leitch or someone like that, where you sit back and be like, whoa, wow, this guy's reinventing the wheel. They just deliver exactly what you expect to get out of it. If there's a car chase, it's done kind of the way that you expect a car chase.
Studio directors, they're kind of like remnants 100%. Of like the old golden age of Hollywood when there were just like, they had, you know, 10 directors that they would rotate through and it was like, oh, just get this guy, just get that guy. Like they understand the system, they understand the studio process. And they, like you say, are competent enough to pull it off logistically and creatively.
I'll say this about this franchise. It does something that current franchises are not able to do, in that it is as filthy R-rated in terms of its language and its violence. The body count in this movie, it has to be triple digits. Like there are scenes where Salma Hayek is just mowing through guys with machine guns and like Sam Jackson is just headshotting guys like left and right. It's not like John Wick, because it's kind of all done for like broad comedy, but the body count just kept piling up, and I was like, how is this movie getting by in the way that they're able to do? And you know they're going to do another one. Like, there's definitely going to be a third one. The way that this one ends sets up a very easy... It's going to be called The Hitman's Wife's Son's Bodyguard. Because there's an entire thing about whether Salma Hayek can have a baby or not. Because her and Sam Jackson are trying to conceive.
Oh, so they set it up. They set it up.
He doesn't know if he's sterile or if she needs to get new eggs, because they play off a lot about the fact that she is older, but she doesn't want to admit that she's older. And so, yeah, it's setting up what's going to happen with a child of these two. Because they're also psychotic. The two characters they play are...
I admire the ridiculous absurdity of it, for sure.
Oh, it's crazy. Like, there's also a very funny bit that I won't give away about who plays Ryan Reynolds' father in the movie. That's all I'll say. It's played for laughs. It really hits. I think that this is fairly entertaining for one of these. Like, I wouldn't go to a theater to go see it, but one day when you're at home and you're watching TNT, and if Jake were here, he'd give me shit for watching something that has a logo at the bottom of it. But you'd be like,
that movie
I'll
on TNT
this.
Would be like 30 seconds
long.
Yeah,
I don't think TNT's buying that movie.
That's true. All right, fine. Maybe like Stars. Okay, Fatherhood is coming to Netflix. That's Kevin Hart. Kev, you saw that?
I liked Fatherhood a lot. Yes.
Did you? Good.
Well, just in terms of like, I found Kevin Hart's performance to be very good.
Okay.
Would I call this a great, profound masterpiece of a film? No, but I enjoyed it. I like Lil Rel Howery. I think he's hilarious. I thought Kevin Hart was funny. But I'm also super immature when it comes to humor. So if you have poop humor and diapers and things like that, and Kevin Hart like talking about poop consistency, it made me laugh. Like, it might have caught me on a day where I just kind of like needed a giggle, and you know, it was. But it's a really interesting story. It's based on a true story, and Hart's character essentially, his wife.
Yeah, what's the plot?
Dies.
Oh, okay.
So his wife dies like a day after their daughter is born. So he has to become obviously the single parent, and it's just kind of his journey with that lifestyle and kind of dealing with his family and his friends, along with raising a daughter. And, you know, I think that Hart in this movie genuinely shows some great dramatic chops. I think he actually has a good dramatic range here. I think there's a couple moments where he like cries and I'm not saying that like if an actor cries, they're a great actor, but it was interesting to see Kevin Hart in that way. Mm. Because I've been watching him so over the years in terms of comedy but his comedy changed a lot when he started having kids, obviously. He has four kids now. But like comedy and the way you live your life are affected obviously by your family. And I think one of the things I really found interesting about him is that he just kind of brings that realism to the role, because he's also kind of been through in terms of like what he does in terms of raising children, not like this character. But I think that he learned from being a father and it kind of brought that fatherhood aspect to the character. I thought it worked well. I mean, at the end of the day, like, is it a film that I would put on my top 10 year of the list? No, but it was passable. It was entertaining. It was fun. It was emotional. And I liked spending time with Kevin Hart in this role. I thought it was, I enjoyed it. And it's, you know, people can watch it and say it's horrible or the best movie ever. It caught me on a day where maybe I was feeling, you know, a little more emotional, and I just kind of like gave myself to it. And I was like, I enjoyed it. It was fun. It's an interesting film based on a true story. And the little girl is phenomenal. Melody Heard is the little girl in the film. Paul Reiser's in the movie. There's some good cast in the movie, for sure.
Check it out on Netflix starting on Friday, depending on when you're listening to this. All right, that brings us to the new Pixar film, Luca. Michelle and I watched this last night. I thought this was... It's weird. It's very cute. I thought it was very sweet. I thought it was very cute. You instantly compare Pixar films to, like, where does it fall in the pantheon of Pixar films? And it's definitely not of the elite kind of thing, but Pixar has now been around long enough where they have a pretty broad range of their films. And obviously they have the ones that are like, you know, I would put Soul, I would put WALL-E, I'd put all those up there on the upper echelon. But then they've made a few that really miss, like Good Dinosaur, or I even put Onward kind of in the you know, really missed.
I love Brave either. I admired Brave, but Brave was one of my lesser favorite. Even though I admired what it did and kind of what the film meant, I just didn't love the movie overall. But The Good Dinosaur is a good, yeah.
I put this right in the middle. You know, I don't think it's as far down as the bad ones, but it didn't elevate beyond, this is a sweet story. You know, I thought the animation was beautiful. It's essentially about, it's kind of like the Little Mermaid. It's underwater sea creatures that want to go up to the surface, but strangely enough, in a way that I don't think it was answered, like if they go to the surface, they just turn into humans. I don't know quite how that happens. There's like a morphing, but it's just sort of passed over. And then, so these two kids form a really close friendship. They want to live on the surface. For reasons they can't return, and they have to go into the Italian town. And there's a story that develops, but again, it never really goes that far. But, overall, I thought it was sweet. I thought it was good for young kids. It'll be on Disney Plus. You don't have to pay the extras, not the $30 extra for it. So I can see a lot of families put it on, but it's nowhere near. It's so funny that they just came off of Soul, which I considered to be the best movie that was released last year. So it's very clearly a step down, but it's still, you know, better than probably most of the... Well, I don't even know, because The Mitchells and the Machines came out earlier this year, and that was a tremendous animated film. So
Pixar brand also got to mention that Lucas stars Dr. Sleep's Jacob Tremblay. He's one of the lead stars of this film.
We never got that picture.
No, we didn't.
I interviewed Tremblay and Jack Dylan Grazer for this, and at the end of the interview I said, I was like, dude, I can't not get over that scene. Dr. Sleep, he goes, my mom still hasn't watched that scene yet. I'm like, good.
Did you mention Jacob? You should have mentioned. Oh, he doesn't know about Jacob, does he? He doesn't know.
I almost brought up Jacob. But I just didn't, it was a Disney junket. I was like, you know, I did bring up the scene, but I didn't be like, hey, Mike told us about this amazing thing where you had a thing called Fake Up Tremblay. Do you think he would have known what that was?
Well, I don't know, because I think they did it when he wasn't around, right?
Yeah, I think they specifically said, like, they didn't want him to see it because they were like, this might just be scarring for a kid his age. Like, that's just, I don't know that we can, it's a responsible thing to do.
For anyone listening to this, go back in our podcast catalog and find our interview with for Dr. Sleep.
Mike Flanagan.
Mike Flanagan gives us a phenomenal. He gave us what, 90 answer.
Minutes?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So good.
Kev, how many stars for Luca? I went 3.5 out of 5 on Luca.
I still have 30 minutes left, so I'm going to finish it this week. Okay. Yeah.
You like what you so far? You like what you're seeing so far?
Oh, yeah. I agree with Sean. As I was watching it, and just, I guess, behind the scenes information, sometimes when we do all these junkets, we'll have like 3 or 4 junkets on a day, and sometimes I can't watch every movie. So I started Luca. I have not finished it yet, but it is... I agree with Sean. Again, I haven't finished this, so I can't really give a full review. It does feel quality-wise lesser than Soul, and it is interesting going from Soul to this because it does feel like a gigantic jump in terms of quality. It doesn't feel like the big Pixar movies that we all love, but at the same time, there are a couple things I loved about it that I will mention. When I was a kid growing up, I used to build bike ramps with my friends. And we would go to like a construction site and find plywood or whatever, and they build these awesome jumps. So one of the things that this movie brought back for me, which made me really happy, was that memory. Because both characters end up building these like really awesome bike jumps out of wood, and they're jumping. So that was cool.
Well, they want to buy a Vespa. Like, they're in Italy, and they both want to own a Vespa. So they tried building one from scratch, and it is pretty sweet.
Yeah, and like, I don't know, there was another part of the movie that I really enjoyed. It was this, again, from what I saw, was this idea of Silencio Bruno, which was this concept of like silencing the critic inside yourself that's telling you you can't do something. And it's a universal theme. We've explored it in films before, but for some reason it worked really well here. I thought Tremblay played the character really well. That, you know, for people who aren't aware, Dylan Grazer's character is the human on land, but I won't spoil anything later. And Tremblay's character is the monster who comes up from the water, turns into a human, and they build a friendship. And there's this element of just like, I related a lot to Tremblay's character. I felt like that was me growing up. I was afraid to do things, and then when you finally do them, it changes your life. And these are all themes that we've covered before. But as I was watching Luca, these are things that kind of stuck out. And I think I realized a lot during this film specifically, and with Soul, is that I just really connect with the Pixar messages. Like, they, mm-hmm. they just do them so freaking well. Soul was one of the most eye-opening films I've ever seen about depression. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Pixar would come out and flat out say, this movie's about depression, but it was, to me, it was about depression. It was about a guy who wasn't happy with his life, who didn't like where he, even though he built this beautiful life, it meant nothing to him unless he got on that stage. And then he realizes later on that once he goes on stage, it wasn't the fulfillment that he needed or yeah. wanted. And I think these movies do such a great job of finding that balance where they teach you beautiful lessons through beautiful stories and animation. And I genuinely believe, you know who's great in this movie is Jim Gaffigan. Yeah. He plays the father. He's great in the movie. I mean, and Maya Rudolph, I believe, is the mom. I want to finish it now. Yeah.
The father from The Italian Town reminded me so much of, there's a short film that Pixar has called La Luna, where they go to the surface of the moon and they sweep up the stars, or they sweep up the surface of it. And the father has a mustache, and his hat goes down to his mustache. And I swear to God, it's the same dad. It looks exactly like him, or at least it reminded me so much of him from that short.
Yeah, I want to go back and finish it because I did the junket on Sunday before I left for Miami. I was in Miami all last week, so I haven't finished it. I'm going to review it Friday, so I'll probably finish it this week. So,
cool. Very cool.
I'll check back in with my ratings. Yeah.
Let us get to the blend game. And this week it is hashtag Ian McKellen blend. And so we will be discussing our favorite films of Sir Ian McKellen. And Gabe, being the third chair, gets to start us off. Where are you going? I know you don't like to play these games, but you're part of it now.
Yeah, but I love Ian McKellen. The first time that I think I must have seen Ian McKellen was Magneto. And I was a huge like X-Men the Animated Series and just superhero animated stuff fan in general by then. So I was like all in when X-Men came out. It was a big part of my childhood. But the year following, I saw him as Gandalf. And my pick is going to be Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings. Pick whatever movie you want. Obviously he has the benefit of playing that character at least 6 times, right? Is he in all 6?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Is he? Yeah. Yeah.
So he's had a lot of time to play that character, but, to me, the Lord of the Rings franchise is just a seminal moment in my life. It's huge from the sense of building my identity or persona as a lover of film, the behind the scenes. Like, I don't know if you remember or ever went back and watched the making ofs, the epic making ofs that came out around the Lord of the Rings franchise. It's a huge reason that I love learning about film, learning how films are made, why I started paying attention to that at such a young age and followed that through to this day. They're special films for me for that reason, beyond just their epic scale and scope and breadth of characters and story arcs that they have within them. And I single that out above, you know, I think he's great as Magneto, and that's another classic character that he played for a couple decades or so, and was fantastic as. And he has the benefit of like a lot of robes and a mountain of hair, but he really does disappear as Gandalf. Gandalf is this like, again, I think because I was so young when I was introduced to the character into the franchise, he's reached that level of sort of ethereal plane in my mind's eye kind of thing of this grand nature of Gandalf. It's not even Ian McKellen. He's just this larger than life character.
Which of the films, if you had to, would you pick to put him in?
You know, I'm in the middle of a rewatch. So that might change.
On purpose?
Which one would I... Probably Return of the King. I could see Return of the King. He's great in Return of the King. I loved him in Fellowship. I'm at Fellowship. I'm watching the extended editions, and I'm taking my time because they're very long. So I've only seen Fellowship so far in the rewatch. Yeah, but he's great in all of them. And I think he's great in the Hobbit films as well. I mean, he's Gandalf.
Yeah.
I didn't love the Hobbit films.
Kev, you are also picking Gandalf?
No question. And Gabe literally hit the nail on the head exactly why this is the choice and there's no other choice. Because I actually forget that Ian McKellen's playing Gandalf. It's Gandalf. Like, that guy on screen is Gandalf. Like there is to a point where I genuinely, when I see Ian McKellen as an actor, I forget that that's the guy who plays Gandalf because it's so convincing. And I get the, it's not just like what Gabe was saying. It's not just the hair and the makeup and the costume. Like, there's something about the ease of his dialogue delivery, the presence of Gandalf. It's all about the atmosphere that he creates. And it's interesting. I would probably, even though Return of the King is my favorite of the trilogy, I would give it to Fellowship for my favorite of his, because it's his ride into Hobbiton. And like when he lights the fireworks off and he's like, and just that whole meeting between him and Elijah Wood in Fellowship, there's just something, the way Elijah goes up to him, there's just something about that magic that makes me feel like that's how I would feel if I was running up to Gandalf. Like Gandalf is, that's the aura that he puts off. It's truly astounding what he does with that character.
And how lucky are we that Ian McKellen even existed at the right time to be Gandalf in that setting? Like a guy who's been playing, you know, Shakespeare since the 60s is the kind of guy you need in order to be this sweet old man at the beginning of the film to, you know, in that, within that first act, whenever he's sort of towering and is very serious and he's like talking about the ring and like is imposing and is scary. He can do both things. And it's because I think it's because he has that range and he's so capable as an actor at that stage.
That scene when he fights, is it Saruman, right? When they're that main battle at the top of that gigantic, the way that he comes across, like Gabe says, like there's a darkness in him that can come out really. Like, do you remember? I don't remember which one it was. I don't know if it was Fellowship or not. But like when the ring would get mentioned, you could see his like the worrisome element go over his face, and like the way he would just change his facial expressions from being happy to see Frodo to like the dangers that are ahead. And he carries that weight within him because there's so much history in Gandalf. And while if you're an audience member who's not read the books and you sit down and watch Fellowship, that history you don't know yet, but you know the character knows it, so you feel the weight of it. And that's kind of what he's carrying through the scene, is he's carrying history and years and years of life and experience as he comes up into the film for the first time. And we really kind of get, we feel that. You feel like you're watching somebody who's really kind of become this person and become this character. And I think Gandalf, it's so interesting. That's probably one of the greatest transitions where, in the sense that I do not see the actor. The actor is non-existent in that movie. It's Gandalf. And there's something to be said about the way, and going back to what Gabe was saying about filmmaking, I was obsessed with the Lord of the Rings behind the scenes footage. Like there was the way that they did the tallness and the shortness of the hobbits and Gandalf, whether it be putting an actor in a ditch 2-3 feet deep so he could stand next to him, or it was forced perspective. I mean, if you go back and watch Fellowship, like the way Peter Jackson was playing with forced perspective and camera angles in terms of making the hobbits look shorter than Gandalf's character or any taller character, it's astounding. They did it seamlessly. And like to play that and make it real for the audience and not make it feel like a filmmaking technique is again another thing. And last thing I'll say about Ian McKellen, I gotta give credit to Howard Shore too, because Shore's score mixed with Gandalf's personality and Ian's performance is one of the best married emotional things I've experienced in cinema. Like that piece of music, that Shore, that main theme he wrote for Lord of the Rings that plays along with Gandalf's like happy entrance is just like, it just gives me chills. Like there's one of the greatest combinations of score and performance I've ever seen. It's just astounding. It brings out more of what Ian put in just by the music.
This is a bit of a tangent. It's Harry Potter related, but you were talking about forced perspective and stuff. Have you ever been to the, I think there's a name for it, the Harry Potter Museum in England?
Leavesden Studios, right?
Yeah, they took the studio where they shot it and they were like, let's just make this an altar to Harry Potter. Have you been there?
Yeah. That is awesome.
You mentioned forced perspective. They have all those like sets built or like models showing up that show you how they shoot that. It's fantastic.
The first place you go into is the actual Great Hall. The first place you walk into is the legit Great Hall, like the prop of it.
Set up that was there. Amazing.
But like, I'm so happy that Peter Jackson made Lord of the Rings when he did, because had he had so much technology in terms of CG, I would have been worried. I mean, I don't know that I think he would have done things as practical as he could have, but there were like, they could have easily like made a CGI Hobbit next to Gandalf and made it look like
that. I think
that,
the Hobbit is proof of that. The Hobbit is proof of if it came about, because even put Peter Jackson aside, think about how much, how big those movies are. And where technology was when The Hobbit came out, like how much harder is the fight for him to convince a studio, to convince, to get the budget for all the practical effects that they did in the Fellowship or in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, when the studio could just say, why don't we just do that in post and we don't have to spend all this time shooting it, which is a terrible thing. But
you know, who's also
feels
good in those
movies is in timing.
The actor who plays Saruman, the gentleman. Is that who that is, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think so. Is that Saruman?
Scene where they fight is so epic. And that goes back to what Gabe was saying. Because you don't truly understand the darkness that's within Gandalf. Like, the wizardry that's within him. And, like, that scene when they're these just two gargantuan
characters. You on the rewatch, I thought that was comical. Like, I thought that it was like really exaggerated, the way that they were like flipping all over the place. And
to me, that was like the way that Peter did that scene, Jackson did that scene, it showed me what
I call him Pete. Like, I just call him Pete.
Pete. But you, how do you capture the power of these characters on screen? How do you tell the audience just how powerful these guys are? If he's flipping him around the room and he's like discombobulated, like that's some pretty wicked. That scene
scares me. I will give you
an
example of one that I think is even better. And it's really funny that Gabe brought up the Harry Potter franchise, because I was thinking in my mind, should I bring this up or should I? How do I interject this? The Harry Potter films have just landed on HBO Max, and like all 8 of them are there. You can flip through them, and I'm not going to sit and watch all of them straight to one through the end. But what I did late at night is jump through a couple of the middle ones and go to scenes that I really, really love. And there's a scene in the end of Order of the Phoenix, I believe it is when they go into the Ministry of Magic. Harry leads all the kids into the Ministry of Magic, and Voldemort and his crew show up. And Dumbledore arrives to almost defend them, kind of thing. And the director, who I think is David Yates, who did that one, does this amazing thing where the sound essentially drops out, right? Like no one's talking. And it's just, it's Voldemort versus Dumbledore. And for the first time in this whole franchise, you realize that Dumbledore is this badass, you know, who has all of this power. And I thought that was a much better explanation of two extremely powerful people going at each other. Like the sound drops out, but all you hear is like the zoom, zoom, and they're each pulling different things. And if you're not watching this and you're listening to it, it probably sounded really stupid, but like they're crashing water down on each other. They're blasting fire at each other. And it's all fast. It's like really fast. And it's, I thought that was a better interpretation, but you guys love Lord of the Rings. I don't like Lord of the Rings.
Actively hate Lord of the Rings.
I really hate Lord of the Rings, which is why for my pick, I mean, there's really only two people, I guess, that most people went to, and I went with Magneto.
Sure.
Because with the first X-Men movie, the casting of the first X-Men movie is just brilliant. What, I just ripped my headphones right out of my ears. So brilliant in that, and Gabe, you mentioned, like, isn't it crazy that Ian McKellen was around to play, like, Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen as Charles Xavier and Magneto are like lifted off the page, you know, like they're so perfect at it to the point. And of course, Jackman as Wolverine, like, you know, you can't top that, but to the point where like when they later recast, I think eventually James McAvoy is doing a good interpretation of Charles Xavier. But I think Michael Fassbender is kind of playing Ian McKellen.
100%. Hasn't he said as such?
Has he?
Fassbender's my favorite scene in cinema dealing with Magneto is from First Class.
At the table?
The bar scene when he says, what do you want to shed first, blood or honor? Like, that is my opinion, the quintessential. And I get that McKellen will, you know, I feel like at the end of the day, he's the ultimate Magneto. But when I think of Magneto, that's the scene that I go to. That's my favorite thing that they've ever done with that character in cinema so far.
Okay. Well,
love that scene.
I like what Ian McKellen did to establish that character. I think it showed too. X-Men came along at a time, and it was 2000 when it got released, and it was one of the first films, because prior to that, it was like Nicholson and Michael Keaton doing Batman. It showed that actors can come into the superhero genre and give really strong performances. You know, it didn't have to be, you weren't slumming it if you took a superhero gig. You know, you could actually come and you could bring nuance to these characters. And I think it opened the door for a lot of other big time performers to come in.
Yeah. And the two of them together is brilliant in the sense that not only, like you said, they feel like they're ripped from the page, but their friendship is automatically believable and their whole history is kind of understood even in that first movie because of their performance, even though we're brought into them when they're diametrically opposed to one another.
I love the subtle touch, and you don't think about it until you see it, but that his prison has to have no metal in it. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like a plastic sort of globe, and he has a chessboard, but the chessboards can't have any metal at all. You know, it's like glass pieces.
He puts like a bunch of iron in his blood in order to break him out, right? Isn't that the shtick in the first one? And like a guard comes in and he like pulls the iron out of his out of his blood.
That's that, right?
Yeah. Hey, what's up, guys? Sorry to be missing the show this week. Miss you guys, love you guys. It was just one of those crazy weeks where we couldn't work out my schedule to get it in time, but I did not want an opportunity to pass without being able to give a shout out to one of the greatest trilogies of all time, of course, Lord of the Rings. Therefore, my pick for Ian McKellen blend is his performance as Gandalf the Grey in The Lord of the Rings, specifically The Fellowship of the Ring. I mean, he captures in that film, one, he disappears completely. He completely captures what I believe Tolkien's idea of Gandalf was, someone who was charming, who was a little mischievous, a little devilish, mysterious in a way, but also wise and comforting. Tough love giving when he needed to be. He was nominated for an Oscar, I think fully deserved to win the Oscar. He is what I would, that performance in particular is what I would classify as sort of a warm blanket kind of performance. It just makes me feel better whenever he's on the screen. Even in movies that I did not like the Hobbit trilogy, when he comes onto the screen, it makes me at least appreciate that moment a little better just because of how good he is. It is, I think, some of the greatest casting of all time. It's one of my favorite performances of this millennium, and I think it is far away not just his best, but my favorite of his incredible, incredible, incredible filmography. I love him as Gandalf, specifically in The Fellowship.
All right, audience picks. Damien McDonnell went with Damien McDonnell, Amy, Eric Carter, and Rob the Mind, and many, many others went with Gandalf. Michelle, Christian Hestas, and many others went with his performance from Gods and Monsters, which is an excellent, excellent film. Not Home Studios, Udit Vedant, Mishra, and others went with Magneto. And then, this has to be a joke, Zach Abdulbaki went with Cats. And on no level is his performance in Cats.
Wait, anyone's I forgot favorite. He was even in Cats.
He is in Cats.
Somebody put, I don't think they were kidding because they gave a real answer. It was like a double answer. But they also said, I forget what the first, I think they might have said Gandalf, but then they said Dumbledore. I was like, you know, two actors played Dumbledore and he was neither of them.
Close. All right, next week, we're going to honor one of the greatest working cinematographers in the industry right now, a hashtag Rachel Morrison blend. For people who don't know Rachel Morrison's work, she did Black Panther, Fruitvale Station, she did Mudbound. Some terrific projects to choose from. So look up Rachel Morrison's IMDb. Go rewatch some of her films. She's an incredible cinematographer. Send your pics using Rachel Morrison. She is R-A-C-H-E-L. Rachel Morrison Blend, or you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. That is also where you can send us reviews if you like the show. We're also telling people, of course, recommend us to your film-loving friends. That's the best way for us to grow the show out. We don't have a review this week, so make sure somebody heads over to Apple Podcast and drops one there for us. Our next premium episode, as I mentioned, is going to be the 2004 Oscars in review. If you want to get access to the premium episodes, you can go to cinemablend.com/RealBlend Premium. And in the meantime, follow all of us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and at Real Blend. Thank you guys for joining us on this week's episode. We'll be back next week with even more amazing content. And until then, Jurassic Park, The Lost World.
QB.
AI. Artificial intelligence.
QB.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.